This is Audible.
Boston Massacre, A History from Beginning to End. American Revolution Book 1. Written by Hourly History. Narrated by Matthew J. Chandler Smith. Introduction. The British called it the Incident on King Street. Future U.S. President John Adams would describe it as the day the foundation of American independence was laid. But the events of March 5, 1770, in which an altercation between 8 British soldiers and an angry Boston crowd left 5 citizens dead, has become known as the Boston Massacre. The name of the incident owes much to the florid invective of Sons of Liberty mastermind Samuel Adams, a patriot dedicated to bringing the people of Boston to his point of view, namely, independence from Great Britain. Boston at this time was a teeming city of 16,000 with a flourishing maritime trade and a fierce adherence to self-government. When the British government sent 4,000 troops to the colony after the successful resolution of the French and Indian War in 1763, the citizens of Boston, who were opposed to the British efforts to address the debt it had undertaken during the war, acted upon their outrage. The troops were in Boston to ensure that customs duties were paid. The protesters were there to make the soldiers' assignment as unpleasant as possible. The soldiers' patience was sorely tested by rowdy townspeople, impudent apprentices, and the ever-present stoking of sentiment by the Sons of Liberty. The vivid sight of the soldiers in the city, their quartering in public buildings, their mere presence was a constant irritant to the Bostonians. After the conclusion of the French and Indian War in 1763, most colonists regarded themselves as loyal British subjects. But loyalty was a circumstance easier to accommodate when living an ocean away from the royal governing authorities. When British forces landed in Boston in 1768 to enforce the collection of unpopular customs duties, the colonists felt as if the city had an army of occupation ruling them. Having the army, the military arm of the government, in the capital city of Massachusetts would serve to turn many of the citizens from a stance of political neutrality to one of almost rabid rebellion. While life in Boston was not so challenging for the officers in the British forces, the ordinary soldier had a far different lot. Punishment was brutal. Desertions ran high in the army. The day-to-day insults and harassment against the troops did not ease the emotions. The Bostonians were free to vent their resentment, while the troops were expected to maintain the peace. It was perhaps inevitable that the simmering frustration would boil over into violence. The Boston Massacre took place on a cold night in March, when snowballs served as a handy weapon for some of the crowd to hurl at a sentry, Hugh White, in position at the customs house. White called out for support, and his summons was answered by Captain Thomas Preston, the officer of the day, a non-commissioned officer, and 6 privates. Preston stood in front of his men and told them not to fire, but the crowd was eager to goad the troops into action. Witnesses who gave depositions after the shooting reported hearing the order to fire. But there was a wide divergence on whether Captain Preston had actually voiced the order. At some point during the night, the word fire was uttered and bullets struck men in the crowd. 3 were killed immediately, 2 died later of their wounds. Eager to avoid any impression of unfairness, the British and the colonials alike were determined to present a fair trial. The Bostonians didn't want to risk losing the self-government and liberty which they enjoyed, and the British didn't want to see the event turn into a civil fissure between Crown and Colony. Acting Governor Thomas Hutchinson, with the agreement of British General Thomas Gage, was able to delay the trial of the British soldiers for 7 months to allow hot tempers time to cool. Samuel Adams, a second cousin to future President John Adams, was quick to exploit the potential of the shootings, and he was instrumental in the publication of A Short Narrative of the Horrid Massacre, a pamphlet which would be printed and sent to London to sway the opinions of the British public to support the colonial position. Adherents intent on justifying the attack also printed their pamphlets in a war of words designed to convince readers that the soldiers were innocent. Not everyone in Boston or the rest of the colonies wanted to be independent of Great Britain. Even the lineup of lawyers for the prosecution and the defense presaged the division that would erupt as men and women chose opposite sides. John Adams, the lead lawyer for the defense of the soldiers, was a patriot by inclination, but he believed in the right to a fair trial regardless of politics. Assisting him in the defense was Josiah Quincy II, also a patriot. Prosecuting the soldiers was Josiah's brother, Samuel Quincy, who was solicitor for the crown. Taking the case reflected his duty, not his personal view. He was a loyalist in his beliefs. The Boston Massacre was a prelude for the American Revolution, and as the British government failed to convince Bostonians that it was willing to hear their grievances, the radical views of Samuel Adams and other members of the Sons of Liberty became more prominent. In 1773, the city would once again take the lead in an act of rebellion against the British when Bostonians, disguised as Mohawk Indians, dumped approximately 92,000 pounds of tea into Boston Harbor, rather than pay the tax on it. British punishment was swift. The port of Boston was closed until the city repaid the British East India Company for the lost tea and damages. The city, which had been seething since the Boston Massacre, Massacre Day was observed annually as a grim reminder of the event, was inflamed anew by this ruling. It was only a matter of time before the British Army and the colonial forces came to blows. 5 years after the Boston Massacre, the 13 colonies and Great Britain were at war. The David and Goliath aspect of the confrontation, as the colonial army fought against the mightiest military in Europe, came to the fore when the Americans, now one country instead of 13 individual colonies, proved their mettle and declared their independence and ultimately victory. Did anyone envision, on the night of March 5, 1770, as Boston citizens lay dead and the British soldiers were in jail, that this event would be the lighting of the fuse that would lead to independence? Many hoped that calm would prevail, but others, including Samuel Adams, hoped for a separation from Great Britain. Whether Adams was a visionary or a hothead is open to debate. But then, much of the Boston Massacre is also worthy of discussion. It was an 18th-century confrontation with tactics and results which can be seen wherever people fight against a superior power, even in modern times. There is, however, one theme which cannot be denied, and that is that the rule of law triumphed. A tribute not only to the tradition of British jurisprudence, but also to the practices of the rustic young nation which owed its legal heritage to the British Empire against which it fought. Chapter 1. From Allies to Enemies. It is truly a miserable thing that we no sooner leave fighting our neighbors, the French, but we must fall to quarreling among ourselves. Reverend Samuel Johnson. With the exploration of the New World across the Atlantic Ocean, the European powers had a new playing field upon which to act out their territorial quarrels. France and Great Britain had been adversaries for centuries, a relationship that was not improved when they both had colonies on the North American continent where their geopolitical tensions could extend for miles across an uncharted wilderness with a vast store of resources. The 13 British colonies in the New World regarded themselves as British subjects, and as such, their enmity against the French was a given during the years when relations were cordial between Great Britain and its colonial possessions. However, the British, French, Spanish, and Dutch were not the only populations affected by the transplanted animosity. The continent was a giant mass of land for the taking, in the eyes of the expansionist-minded Europeans, and as the native tribes watched the encroachment of the white settlers, it soon became obvious that they needed to choose sides if they were going to have any hopes of retaining the lands that had belonged to them for as long as their tribes had memory. Early in the 1750s, as France expanded its reach into the Ohio River Valley, The French and their Native American allies fought against the colonial Americans in what became known as the French and Indian War. To the French, the Ohio River Valley was part of New France and belonged to them. For the British, the Ohio River Valley was part of the colony of Virginia, the territory that currently makes up the states of Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois was the frontier, and it soon became the front lines of what was actually a global war. There had been prior wars fought on colonial soil between the British and the French, King William's War, which took place from 1688 through 1697, Queen Anne's War from 1702 through 1713, and King George's War from 1744 through 1748. All of these conflicts were proxy fights for supremacy between the European foes who had found that their enmity had crossed the Atlantic Ocean. The imperial tentacles of the dominant European powers reached far, and it wasn't long before the war on the colonies evolved into a global conflict, spreading to Europe in 1756 and involving almost all of the significant European powers. At stake was control of the vast North American continent and its wealth of resources, the lucrative fur trading industry, and access to the Ohio River, a major source of transportation for a country with limited roads. The British were fighting a powerful alliance of French and Native Americans, and in the beginning, the British were not faring well. Then, in 1757, the British government, led by Prime Minister William Pitt the Elder, came to the realization that this was not a faraway skirmish, but a threat to British imperial goals. If the French won North America, Great Britain's global influence would be diminished. The British borrowed significantly and took on debt financed by British and Dutch bankers in order to pay for the war by helping fund Prussia's fight against the French and by providing the means for the colonists to raise troops for the battles. By 1760, the French had lost Canada to the British. By 1763, Great Britain's dominance had overcome the efforts of both Spain, which had tried to ally itself with France in its bid for American expansion, and France, which also saw itself on the losing end against the British in India. In 1763, the Treaty of Paris was signed. France relinquished all its claims to Canada. Great Britain added to its colonial territory with the acquisition of Upper Canada and Spanish Florida, as well as other French possessions abroad. The British colonies in North America benefited as well with the removal of European threats to the North and South. Seemingly, the French and Indian War cemented the ties between Great Britain, the mother country, and its 13 colonial possessions. A forecast of the future would seem to indicate that the British would continue to enjoy dominance upon the North American continent, and a flourishing of the trade between the natural wealth of the untapped colonies and the burgeoning British Empire. War, however, was a costly enterprise, and the British government hoped to recoup on its financial expenses. The British government felt that it was high time for the colonies to begin to pay for the expenses incurred in their defense. The colonists did not expect the British to maintain an army on American soil, but King George III not only intended to maintain the world's largest standing peacetime army, but he also expected the colonists to foot the bill for its maintenance. This was not the only reminder that the American colonies were subject to royal decree. The Proclamation of 1763 limited the expansion of the colonies, setting a barrier to any further movement west. The restless colonies, lured by the enticement of acres and acres of land to the west, felt constrained by the treaty which denied them the freedom to go where they chose. The British felt that it was unfair and unrealistic of their colonial possessions to expect Great Britain to have incurred massive debt on behalf of the colonies without these colonies helping to pay for it. As the newly acquired territory required military protection, the British government expected the colonies to fund the cost of maintaining British troops on American soil and in American buildings and homes. The obvious way to repay the cost of the war was to assess taxes on the colonies in order to raise revenue. Great Britain's national debt in 1754 was £75 million. When the war ended in 1763, the debt had almost doubled to £133 million. In the British view, as the colonies were the beneficiaries of the treaty, its 13 children needed to take on their share of the burden from a war that had directly impacted them and not the citizens of Great Britain. Before the war, the colonies provided their own defense with their militias, which they outfitted and equipped on their own. But that homespun process seemed a dubious one to the British, who doubted that the rustic militias could securely defend the acquired territory which extended west of the Appalachian Mountains and into Canada, where significant numbers of native tribes lived. What was needed, the British felt, was a professional standing army. But as the colonists were reaping the benefits of their defense provided by that standing army, they should expect to bear the expense of maintaining it. In the eyes of Parliament, this should not have been a contentious issue. The colonies had not suffered financial hardship as a result of fighting the war. That burden had been endured by the British people. And at this time, a colonist in America paid less than 1/20th the amount of taxes that his British counterpart living in Great Britain paid while enjoying more freedom and opportunity. The colonies did not hold the same view, and when the taxes began to be assessed by Great Britain, there was a stirring of resentment. It did not swell into rebellion, not yet, but as the Stamp Act was being passed in the 1760s, the colonists began to seethe. What right, they protested, did Parliament have to tax the colonies when the colonies had no representation in Parliament? In 1766, Parliament made it clear, with the passing of the Declaratory Act, that the colonies were subordinate to and dependent upon Great Britain's King and Parliament. The taxes at this point became more than a means of raising revenue. They were a way to remind the colonies of who was in charge. But, like rebellious offspring determined to prove that they were adults, the colonies were not of a mind to be docile, and in the province of Massachusetts, the seeds of independence were already being sown in fertile ground. Chapter 2. Taxation Without Representation. A true patriot would keep the attention of his fellow citizens awake to their grievances, and not allow them to rest till the causes of their complaints are removed. Samuel Adams. The Stamp Act of 1765 taxed the colonials for every piece of paper they purchased. The act was vehemently opposed by the colonists. Dedicated to the principles of self-government, the colonists insisted that they could only be taxed by their own representative assemblies. Their responses turned to violence to intimidate the officials assigned to collect the stamps, who often found it safer to resign their positions rather than enforce the law. The unpopular law was repealed in 1766, but Parliament wasn't about to cede authority to the colonial powers. The Declaratory Act was issued upon the repeal of the Stamp Act, making the point that rescinding one unpopular law did not constitute surrender. With the passage of the Townshend Acts in 1767, Parliament seemed to be setting in motion a series of events designed to lead to conflict, although no one at the time likely realized the extent to which American resentment would go. The Townshend Acts were a series of four acts designed to assert parliamentary authority over the colonists. The New York Restraining Act forbade the New York Assembly from performing its governmental responsibilities until it accepted the terms of the Quartering Act, which required the colony to absorb the expense of stationing British troops. The Revenue Act imposed direct duties which would end up in the British Treasury with the aim of raising revenue and not regulating trade, something with which the colonials were more familiar. These duties were to be paid at the ports and were levied on glass, paper, paint, lead, and tea. Customs collection was the basis of the Third Act and included Coast Guard vessels, additional officers, spies, searchers, and search warrants. writs of assistance, and a board of customs commissioners in Boston. The funds for these services would come from the customs revenues. Along with the Revenue Act came the Commissioners of Customs Act, which created a board of commissioners that would operate in the colonies with the authority to oversee the collection of all the import taxes. Violators of the law would be prosecuted. The fourth act was the Indemnity Act, designed to support the British East India Company in its commercial competition against the Dutch. Commercial duties on tea that the East India Company imported to England were lowered, and the company received a refund of the duty for tea exported to the colonies. The Townshend duties aimed to compensate for the loss of revenue from the Indemnity Act. The 13 colonies had enjoyed the freedom afforded them by the distance between North America and Great Britain. They had adapted to self-government and assessed their own taxes through their provincial assemblies. The Townshend Acts lit a fuse of indignation that met with not only spoken dissent, but also physical retaliation as well. British enforcement agents encountered hostility as they sought to collect the duties. Merchants renewed non-importation agreements. The effort to evade the payment of the duties was deliberate. For Boston merchants, the customs duties were particularly onerous and inconvenient. For a wealthy merchant like John Hancock, there was the temptation not to pay the duties. When a cargo of Madeira wine aboard Hancock's vessel Liberty arrived in Boston on May 9, 1768, the prominent Bostonian decided not to pay the duties. A customs official was held as a hostage during the time that the wine was being unloaded off the ship and taken to Hancock's warehouse. As a result of the violation of the customs payment and the treatment of the official, Hancock's ship was seized a month later. In response, customs officials were set upon by rioters. The public demonstration would cost the city heavily. Alarmed at the rise in violence, Governor Francis Bernard requested that the British send troops to maintain order. In response, the 14th and 29th Regiments arrived in September 1768 to protect government officials who were at risk of harm from attacks by mobs. They were also assigned to restore order and, of course, to ensure that the taxes were collected. The Bostonians were outraged. The soldiers were spat upon, insulted, and before long, fighting broke out. Over the course of the next 18 months, the friction between the soldiers and the public continued to increase. The soldiers were under their orders, and the Bostonians made it quite clear that the red-coated lobsterbacks were not welcome. According to the Quartering Act of 1765, the expense of quartering the British troops fell upon the local legislature. It was not an easy matter to find lodgings for the troops, and the decision to move them to Castle Island, 3 miles south of Boston, meant that they would not be immediately at hand if needed. Governor Bernard decided to rent empty warehouses and wharfs in Boston to use as barracks, a move which incensed Bostonians who resented the presence of British troops in their midst. The soldiers were permitted to take on part-time work when they were off duty, which increased the likelihood of altercations between the soldiers and the civilians who were also employed in these jobs in the warehouses. Political agitators, including Samuel Adams, found the elements for rebellion all too easy to ignite. Adams was an expert propagandist, organizing the publication of articles attesting to atrocities committed by the British troops. The Sons of Liberty was actively involved in resisting what the organization perceived as the incursion of British tyranny into the rights of the colonists to govern themselves. The underground organization promoted confrontations between the civilians and the soldiers with the eventual goal of seeing the simmering pot boil over into rebellion. The Sons of Liberty had already proven their potency in 1765, when a group of merchants sent a letter to the newly appointed official collector of taxes imposed by the Stamp Act. He was told to appear at noon in Boston's South End and publicly resign his post. If he did so, he was told that he would be treated with politeness and humanity. If he failed to do so, the Sons of Liberty left that fate to his imagination. As 2,000 Bostonians watched and waited, Andrew Oliver walked in the rain to publicly quit his post, saving himself from finding out just what might come to pass if he failed to obey the dictates of the Sons of Liberty. Samuel Adams' tactics had worked. Adams's father was a brewer who was wealthy enough to send his son to Harvard, where young Adams wrote his master's thesis on why it was lawful to resist the rule of the British. Other members of the Sons of Liberty who would rise to prominence included Paul Revere, John Hancock, and Benedict Arnold. But it was Samuel Adams who became almost synonymous with the organization and its efforts to undermine British authority in the colony of Massachusetts. Autumn turned into winter, but the colder weather did not bring cooler heads. The temperament of the city continued to be volatile. Francis Bernard, governor of Massachusetts province, resigned his position in 1769 and was replaced by acting governor Thomas Hutchinson. The colonies began to show their resentment, particularly in Boston, where animosity toward the Townshend Acts was especially virulent. Ironically, back in Great Britain, on March 5, 1770, the Quartering Act requirements were lifted, revenue duties were repealed on everything but tea, and troops were to be removed from Boston. The news had not reached Boston, and when it did, it was too late. Chapter 3. The Shooting on March 5th. "For God's sake, take care of your men. If they fire, you must die." Henry Knox. The cold winter weather had not been able to quell the passions of the Boston civilians who continued to be outraged by the presence of the British troops sent to enforce the collections of the customs duties which were part of the hated Townshend Acts. Despite the ongoing confrontations taking place between the soldiers and the public, there was no awareness that on March 5, 1770, the events would dramatically escalate from insults to injury. Private Hugh White was stationed as a sentry in front of the Boston Custom House on King Street when an altercation broke out between one of the British officers and a wigmaker's apprentice. The apprentice taunted the soldier because he claimed that the officer had neglected to pay his master for his wig. The officer, Captain Lieutenant John Goldfinch, had actually settled the bill the day before, but the sentry got involved, chiding the apprentice for his disrespect toward the officer. After a series of insults, the apprentice, Edward Garrick, poked Private White in the chest. The sentry left his post and struck the apprentice with his musket. As a friend took up the quarrel on Garrick's behalf, a crowd began to form. When the church bells began to ring, the citizenry of Boston were aware that something important was brewing. Although many probably thought the bells signaled a fire burning, as church bells were the usual means of announcing that help was needed to put out the flames. Before long, more than 50 Bostonians encircled the sentry under the leadership of a former slave named Crispus Attucks. The crowd goaded the sentry by throwing things at him, and White took safety by moving to the steps of the custom house. Before long, a substantial mob consisting of young men spoiling for a fight gathered around White. The sentry rushed to the door of the customs house shouting, "Turn out, main guard!" In response, Corporal William Wems and Privates Hugh Montgomery, James Hartigan, John Carroll, William Warren, William McCauley, and Matthew Kilroy accompanied Captain Thomas Preston, who ordered the men to fix bayonets. Preston was aware that the situation required delicate handling, and he knew that the temperament of the crowd was spoiling for action. It was up to him to keep his men from firing and exacerbating the situation. Upon reaching the custom house, the soldiers loaded their muskets and formed a semicircle around White. After assuming a position which clearly identified their military position, Preston ordered the crowd, which had grown from 50 to more than 300, to disperse. The crowd, however, was in a reckless mood, responding to Preston by spitting on the soldiers, hurling snowballs at them, and goading them by yelling, "Fire!" A Boston innkeeper armed with a cudgel asked Preston whether the British soldiers' guns were loaded. Preston responded that they were, but that the men would not fire unless ordered by Preston to do so. When an object that was flung from the crowd struck Private Montgomery, the soldier was knocked to the ground and he dropped his musket. After recovering his weapon, he swore at the crowd and fired his weapon, despite the fact that Preston had not given the order to fire. The innkeeper struck Montgomery with his cudgel and then struck Preston. A brief period of time passed, perhaps as little as a few seconds, perhaps as long as 2 minutes, depending on the testimony of eyewitnesses. Then the soldiers began to fire, although Preston would later claim that he had not given the order. 3 men in the crowd died instantly. Crispus Attucks, who had been part of the mob from the beginning, a mariner named James Caldwell, and a ropemaker named Samuel Gray. A 17-year-old apprentice, Samuel Maverick, who was hit by a ricochet, died the following morning, and an immigrant from Ireland, Patrick Carr, would die 9 days after being shot. Bostonians began to edge away from the custom house, but the news of the shooting spread rapidly, and crowds were gathering in the streets nearby. Acting Governor Thomas Hutchinson rushed to King Street. He was met with Captain Preston, who was shaken by the ordeal. Hutchinson said to him, "Do you know, sir, you have no power to fire on anybody of the public collected together, except you have a civil magistrate with you give orders." Hutchinson then went upstairs to join several other members of the council, then stood on the balcony to address the crowd in the streets. Ordering them to disperse, he said, "Let the law have its course. I will live and die by the law." It was after midnight when Boston Justices John Tudor and Richard Dania issued a warrant for Captain Preston's arrest. He was brought to the townhouse and interrogated. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the justices, finding enough evidence against Preston, sent him to jail where he would be held for the next 7 months. Events moved swiftly. Boston selectmen asked the acting governor to move the troops from the city to Castle Island. The governor's council opposed the idea. Hutchinson claimed that he lacked the authority to give such an order. However, those in attendance at the town meeting were very persuasive, and the council finally relented to their wishes, although Hutchinson wrote that the decision was made under duress. The council was in a bind. They feared that if the troops remained in the city, given the mood of the public after the deaths of the citizens, the soldiers might come to harm, an occurrence which would result in the city losing its charter and its right to govern itself. On March 8th, the first 4 men killed by the soldiers were buried. Slightly more than a week later, Patrick Carr, who died on March 14th, was buried with the others. The 14th Regiment was moved to Castle Island a week after the night of the shooting, and the 29th Regiment followed soon after. There was no incident accompanying this troop withdrawal, although their removal meant that the acting governor had no professional troops at his disposal should the city need order to be enforced. In May, General Gage ordered the 29th Regiment out of Massachusetts. Chapter 4. How the Incident on King Street Became the Boston Massacre. Every circumstance connected with this wanton and sanguinary event is important to be noticed. The people were provoked beyond endurance, and they can be justly accused only of resisting a fierce and vindictive soldiery, at the hazard of life. A short narrative of the horrid massacre. Samuel Adams was an influential man in Boston for reasons which put him at odds with the acting governor. Hutchinson called him the Great Incendiary for his stance on the rights of the colonies when they were in opposition to royal prerogative. His second cousin, John Adams, of a demeanor less radical than Samuel, viewed Samuel as one who made it his constant rule to warn against the hostile designs of Great Britain. Both the Adams men had been educated at Harvard. John Adams, who was younger, had studied law. Samuel Adams, then 47 years old, was the recording clerk for the Massachusetts House. He was also a vehement patriot, a leader of the Sons of Liberty, and a skilled propagandist who frequently wrote letters to newspapers under an alias in support of his views. When a citizens' group met after the shootings to determine their course of action, they chose Samuel Adams to chair a committee to petition the acting governor to remove the troops immediately. To Hutchinson's claim that he did not have the authority to do this, Adams replied, "Sir, if the lieutenant governor or Colonel Dalrymple, or both together, have the authority to remove 1 regiment, they have the authority to remove 2, and nothing short of a total evacuation of the town, by all regular troops, will satisfy the public mind or preserve the peace. Acting Governor Hutchinson, realizing that it was to his advantage to delay the trial of the British soldiers as long as he could, while the friction between the military and the citizens cooled, was able to hold off the trial until months later. He was encouraged in his efforts by General Thomas Gage, the commander of the British forces in the colonies. Not long after the episode, Hutchinson wrote, "In matters of dispute between the king and the colonies, government is at an end and in the hands of the people." The leaders of both factions were not idle during this cooling-off period. Both sides were eager to present their cases to the public in the form of a media frenzy. 18th-century publicity may have lacked the unceasing coverage that modern-day news receives through technology, but that didn't prevent the supporters sympathetic to the Patriot cause and those who remained loyal to the British from doing their utmost to sway public opinion. According to the Boston Gazette, the deaths of the five civilians in a shooting, now heralded as a massacre, was the consequence of quartering the soldiers in Boston and had been part of a conspiracy to stifle the spirit of liberty. The effort to win proponents went as far as London, where pamphlets were published to bring the British public into the audience. One of the most influential pamphlets, which would include observations from Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and Joseph Warren on the events leading up to the March 5th shootings, as well as 96 depositions taken after the shootings, was ready within a few days after the shooting. This was the sort of assignment in which Samuel Adams reveled. He made the defense of slain Crispus Attucks the focal point of his argument, refuting claims that the former slave was one of the antagonists of the altercation. His letters to the Boston Gazette asserted that Attucks had as good a right to carry a stick, even a bludgeon, as the soldier who shot him had to be armed with musket and ball. The pamphlet was submitted to a town meeting in Faneuil Hall on March 19th, where it was approved for by the town of Boston. It was printed and on its way to London soon after. The pamphlet included accusations that the soldiers had marched to the custom house with the deliberate intention of doing harm to the civilians who were gathered there. This pamphlet, titled A Short Narrative of the Horrid Massacre, was the most effective of the numerous publications circulating through the city as a written vehicle to prove that the leaders of the colony were neutral and balanced in their actions. Its efficacy can be judged not only by the fact that printed copies remaining in Boston were impounded, but also by the fact that it would be used by a member of the prosecution when the soldiers came to trial. Another pamphlet claimed that customs officials were leaving their posts. One of the customs officials who abandoned his post had left the city in order to deliver Acting Governor Hutchinson's depositions to London. These depositions, which were taken mostly from the British soldiers, would be published in another pamphlet entitled A Fair Account of the Late Unhappy Disturbance in Boston. In this version, Bostonians themselves were to blame for having violated the laws legitimately established by Parliament. They were the ones, the pamphlet said, who had created an atmosphere of civil unrest after the arrival of the soldiers. The pamphlet also claimed that the citizens had set up an ambush of the soldiers. This pamphlet was not published until after the first pamphlet espousing the innocence of the Bostonians had already arrived in London and, as a result, had minimal impact on the British citizens it was striving to persuade. Pamphlets weren't the only means of persuading the public. An engraving by Henry Pelham went viral in the manner of the times. It showed Captain Preston giving the order to fire on the crowd. From a window in the custom house, a musket was showing. The bloody graphic was published in the Boston Gazette, and from there, it went on to become a familiar print in the houses of the region. It didn't matter that the engraving failed to accurately depict Crispus Attucks, showing him as a white man rather than a mixed-race former slave, or that the image neglected to reflect the nighttime attack. Its discrepancies, or perhaps willful departures from the truth, were not what mattered to the propagandists who felt that they had been attacked by a vicious British military. Chapter 5. Origin of Reasonable Doubt. On my asking the soldiers why they fired without orders, they said they heard the word fire and supposed it came from me. This might be the case, as many of the mob called out fire, fire, But I assured the men that I gave no such order, that my words were, "Don't fire, stop your firing." In short, it was scarcely possible for the soldiers to know who said fire, or don't fire, or stop your firing. Captain Thomas Preston. The trial of Captain Thomas Preston was scheduled first, but in order to have a trial, the British officer needed a lawyer. The Boston authorities wanted to ensure that the British soldiers received a fair trial, although Bostonian motives were not entirely altruistic. They were concerned that the British might retaliate if they felt that the soldiers were victims of an unfair judicial process, and they were also concerned that too inflammatory a trial could sour moderates from perceiving the Patriot agenda as a legitimate course of action. The charges against the soldiers were serious, carrying a possible death sentence if they were found guilty, and no one wanted to take a case that was certainly going to be an unpopular one in a city already inflamed against the presence of the British. The morning after the shooting, a Boston merchant went to see John Adams in his law office near the stairs of the town office. James Forrest asked Adams to take the case in defense of Preston and the soldiers. John Adams, then a 35-year-old lawyer with some thoughts of eventually running for political office, agreed to take the case, although he knew it would do no benefit for his professional reputation. There was also the risk of threats to his wife and young family in retaliation for his decision to defend the soldiers. Adams recognized the peril of his choice. In a letter to his wife, Abigail, he wrote, "I have consented to my own ruin, to your ruin, and to the ruin of our children." Adams was a patriot, but he also believed in the judicial concept that everyone was entitled to a fair trial. His pay for taking the case would be 18 guineas, a somewhat modest sum. There was also the possibility that, in exchange for agreeing to take the case, he would be given a seat in the Boston legislature. As it came to pass, when a seat did become available 3 months later, Adams was Boston's first choice to fill it. Joining Adams in the defense team was Josiah Quincy II, who took the position after assurance that the Sons of Liberty would not oppose his addition to the defense, and Robert Auchmuty, a loyalist. Samson Salter Blowers was given the task of investigating the pool of potential jurors. Massachusetts Solicitor General Samuel Quincy, the solicitor for the Crown and the King's attorney for Massachusetts, the older brother of Josiah Quincy and a loyalist who would later leave Massachusetts for Great Britain in 1776, never to return, was hired to prosecute the case against the soldiers. Assisting him in the prosecution was Robert Treat Payne, a private attorney. Payne would make use of a short narrative of the horrid massacre for his prosecution. 7 months passed after the shootings on March 5th before the trials of the British soldiers began, as Hutchinson and General Gage, commander of the British troops in the colonies, wanted to give hot colonial tempers time to cool down, even though the Sons of Liberty were actively engaging in doing everything within their power to rev up the emotions of the Boston public. The perception of fair justice was important both to the British and to Boston. For the British, there was the worry that if the soldiers did not have to undergo a trial, the volatile situation in Boston could steer the public further toward the independence movement, a direction which the Sons of Liberty was already promoting. The Boston authorities, likewise, wanted to avoid the appearance of anything which would make their fellow colonists decide that justice was better served if the British were in charge. On October 24th, the trial of Captain Thomas Preston began. The trial would last for 6 days, which was an unusually long time for trials at that time, and one of the longest trials in colonial history. Juries at this time were generally not sequestered, but in this case, the jurors, who were selected from outside of Boston, were kept away from their family and neighbors in order to prevent them from being influenced by outside opinions on the subject. The jurors, who were fed biscuit and cheese and cider, along with spirits liquor, during the trial, would hear Adams build a case around the doubt of whether or not Preston had actually given his men the order to fire. Although Preston pleaded not guilty, he did not testify. He had already provided his account of the events leading to the shootings. The defense team's case was based upon proving that Preston had never given the order to fire and had not ordered the shootings. The British troops, Preston said in his account, knew that their presence was, as he put it, extremely obnoxious to its inhabitants. Local citizens had done whatever possible to weaken the regiments, telling lies about the soldiers, trying to persuade the troops to desert, and creating an atmosphere of hostility. Even the magistrates, Preston claimed, had supported the belligerence of the citizens against the soldiers. The officers had done all that was possible, he said, to keep the soldiers from responding to the provocations of the citizens. When he heard the church bells, he assumed it was the usual signal announcing that there was a fire. But around 9 o'clock, some of the guard informed him that townspeople were assembling for the purpose of attacking the soldiers, and the bells were actually a signal to bring in others to join the mob. Preston went to the guard, where he saw hundreds of people gathered, making threats against the soldiers. He noticed the pugnacious attitude of the crowd and believed the sentry who told him that the mob intended to take him from his post and murder him. Preston thought that murdering the sentry was a preliminary part of a plan to steal the money from the customs house. This money was the property of the British King George III. Preston sent a non-commissioned officer and some men to protect the money and the sentry, following soon after to do what he could to maintain order and prevent the soldiers from responding to the insults of the crowd. Preston recalled the insults of the crowd daring the soldiers to fire, while Preston put himself between the mob and his soldiers, trying to urge the people to disperse. The people pressed closer, as far as the bayonet points. When he was asked whether the guns were charged, he answered yes, but that he did not intend to order the men to fire. Preston was in the line of fire, and if he ordered the soldiers to fire, he would surely be a casualty. As he spoke, a member of the crowd struck one of the soldiers, who then fired. When Preston demanded why the soldier had fired, he was hit on his arm by the man who had struck the soldier. The force of the injury prevented him from having the use of his arm for some time. The response of the crowd was to hit the soldiers with heavy clubs and snowballs, all while swearing at the soldiers and taunting them as to why they didn't fire. Then, in the confusion of the moment, some of the soldiers did fire. 3 men were killed. The mob fled. The episode took approximately 20 minutes. Preston asked the soldiers why they had fired without him giving the order, and they, having heard the word fire, assumed that it had come from Preston. When some of the crowd returned to remove the dead bodies, the soldiers, thinking that they meant to attack, were ready to fire again until Preston explained that he prevented by striking up their firelocks with my hand. Preston reported that he then learned that 4,000 or 5,000 people were assembling in the nearby street, vowing to kill him and to take every other soldier's life as well. He ordered his soldiers to go to the main guard where the street was narrow and short, planting themselves at the end of the street in order to secure the rear in case of attack. The 29th Regiment joined them. The mob continued to respond with violence, leading the lieutenant governor and a regimental officer to decide that it would be more prudent for the regiment to return to their barracks and the townspeople to their homes. Finally, most of the crowd dispersed. Learning that a warrant had been issued for his arrest, Preston surrendered himself to the sheriff, although, as he pointed out, he had 4 hours in which he could have made his escape. He did not flee, he explained, because he was not guilty. Witnesses asserted that they had heard Preston use the word fire, but could not state whether it had been given as an order. Other witnesses said they heard someone say fire, but did not know who said it. The lawyers for the prosecution summoned 15 witnesses to the stand to refute the claim that Preston had not ordered his men to shoot. Cross-examination demonstrated that the witnesses' testimony was contradictory. The defense lawyers called 23 witnesses who testified that the crowd had provoked and intimidated the soldiers. The lawyers pressed the witnesses to answer the question of who had given the order to fire. When the jury returned after a few hours of deliberation with a verdict on October 30th, Captain Preston was acquitted of the charges against him on the basis of reasonable doubt, the first time that a judge issued this phrase when rendering a verdict. Captain Preston was free, but the fate of his men remained in doubt. Chapter 6. Benefit of the Clergy. Captain Preston was within 2 yards of me, and before the men and nearest to the right and facing the street. I was looking at him, did not hear any order. He faced me. I think I should have heard him. I distinctly heard a voice say, "Damn you, why do you fire? Don't fire." I thought it was the captain's then. I now believe it. Daniel Cornwall, citizen of Boston. The British soldiers awaiting trial were not happy that their case would be tried separately from that of Captain Preston. They sent a letter to the court on October 21st, stating, "We poor distressed prisoners beg that ye would be so good as to let us have our trial at the same time with our captain. For we did our captain's orders, and if we do not obey his command, should have been confined and shot for not doing it." These soldiers were concerned that they would be given the scapegoats if Preston said that he had not given the order to fire, which would nullify any claim of theirs that they were merely following orders. In modern law, an attorney could not have defended both parties, but this was not a conflict in 1770. Still, the request of the soldiers to be tried with Captain Preston was denied. No explanation was given. The case against the soldiers was based upon the enmity which the troops had for the townspeople, but Josiah Quincy opened for the defense on November 27th by stating that the case could only be judged by the evidence produced in court. Well aware of the tempestuous mood of the public, the lawyers for the defense intended to conduct a case that was based on evidence, not emotion. One of the witnesses called by the defense lawyers was Dr. John Jeffries, the physician who had attended to the mortally ill Patrick Carr. Carr had been shot through the abdomen while crossing the street as the shooting got underway. The conversation between Carr and the physician took place in the afternoon of March 14th. Carr would die later that night. Carr had told the surgeon that as a native of Ireland, he had often witnessed soldiers called upon to put down a mob and had seen the Irish fired upon by those troops. But never in his life, Carr said, had he witnessed soldiers bear half as much before they fired. Carr told Dr. Jeffries that he was satisfied that the man who shot him had fired to defend himself. Carr bore him no malice and forgave him. Because of the belief at the time that a man preparing to face his divine maker would not lie, Carr's deathbed testimony, although hearsay, was admitted and proved to be very influential in guiding the jury to reach its verdict. Samuel Adams, reacting to the testimony, was of the opinion that Carr, being Irish, was likely a Roman Catholic, and as such, should not be trusted by the Protestant citizens of Boston. John Adams did not allow family loyalty to subdue his quest for truth. He presented evidence showing that there was reason to blame not only the mob that had assembled the night of the shootings, but also the British policy of quartering its troops in the city. Urging the jury to look beyond the British nationality of the soldiers, Adams said, "Soldiers quartered in a populous town will always occasion two mobs where they prevent one. The soldier who fired first had behaved as might be expected of anyone in such life-threatening circumstances," Adams said. "Do you expect that he should act like a stoic philosopher, lost in apathy? Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our inclinations, or the dictums of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence." Refuting the assertions of his cousin Samuel, John Adams described Crispus Attucks as an agitator. Attucks, who had served as a sailor on whaling voyages, feared that he would be impressed into the British Navy. Working as a part-time laborer, he also resented the competition presented by the British troops, who worked part-time in their off-duty hours for lower wages. Attucks had been in the front of what Adams, speaking at a time when political correctness was clearly not expected of an attorney, described as a motley rabble of saucy boys, negroes and mulattoes, Irish teagues and outlandish jacktars, who were goading the sentry, Private Hugh White, in front of the custom house. The arrival of troops had not quelled the mob. In fact, the addition of the soldiers seemed to inflame the mob, and Attucks was at the forefront, daring the soldiers to fire. A witness said that he had seen Attucks grab Hugh Montgomery's bayonet and knock him down with a club. But James Bailey, another witness, said that Attucks had been 15 feet away from Montgomery. In any case, the British muskets began to fire after Montgomery was struck. Adams fell first, struck in the chest by two bullets. Adams did not deny that the soldiers' bullets had struck and killed citizens, but he pointed out that it was within their legal rights to fight back against the attack of the mob. At most, he said, they were guilty of manslaughter. Summing up his defense before the jury, Adams said, "If an assault was made to endanger their lives, the law is clear, that they had a right to kill in their own defense. If it was not so severe as to endanger their lives, yet if they were assaulted at all, struck and abused by blows of any sort, by snowballs, oyster shells, cinders, clubs, or sticks of any kind, this was a provocation, for which the law reduces the offense of killing, down to manslaughter, in consideration of those passions in our nature, which cannot be eradicated. To your candor and justice I submit the prisoners and their cause." After 2.5 hours of deliberation, the jury acquitted all but two of the soldiers of the murders. Private Matthew Kilroy was found guilty of manslaughter for the death of Samuel Gray. Private Hugh Montgomery was found guilty of manslaughter for the killing of Crispus Attucks. The two soldiers could have been sentenced to death, but Adams negotiated for a lesser sentence, taking advantage of a time-honored practice of British law that dated back to medieval times called the benefit of the clergy. To escape execution, they only needed to prove that they could read Psalm 51, verse 1, which was known as the neck verse. "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according unto the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions." This provision had been established at a time when most of the population was illiterate. Interestingly, Kilroy was actually not able to read, but because the requirement for literacy had been abolished in 1705, he was still granted the benefit of clergy. On December 14th, the two men went into court and held up their right thumbs for branding. Kilroy and Montgomery were branded on the thumbs with the letter M, indicating murder. The brand was a visible notice that they had had the benefit of clergy once. If they ever committed murder again, they would not be able to invoke this mercy a second time. Four Boston civilians were also tried for their part in the shootings. The trial took place on December 13th. All four were acquitted. Chapter 7. Aftermath of the Massacre. Judgment of death against those soldiers would have been as foul a stain upon this country as the executions of the Quakers or witches, anciently. As the evidence was, the verdict of the jury was exactly right. This, however, is no reason why the town should not call the action of that night a massacre, nor is it any argument in favor of the governor or minister, who caused them to be sent here. But it is the strongest proofs of the danger of standing armies. John Adams. Captain Preston was not sorry to leave Boston. When his trial concluded, he wrote, "I take the liberty of wishing you joy at the complete victory obtained over the knaves and foolish villains of Boston." He sailed home for England in December and received £200 for the trials that he had endured while in the service of the king. For Acting Governor Thomas Hutchinson, the Boston Massacre was a preview of what lay in store for the conflicted colony he governed. During the riots that arose in response to the Stamp Act, his home had been attacked by a mob. In 1773, Bostonians responded to the tax on tea by dumping a shipment overboard into Boston Harbor. Hutchinson resigned his post soon after and left for London. Samuel Adams, naturally, was not at all pleased by the verdicts acquitting the British soldiers of the murders of the five victims of the March 5th shooting. He expressed his displeasure with the way the trial was conducted, what he saw as the misuse of evidence, and the verdicts themselves in his writings. He remained as passionately devoted to the cause of liberty as he had been prior to the trials, an activist for independence and a forceful leader of the Sons of Liberty. Samuel Adams organized a boycott of imported goods among the merchants and participated in the Boston Tea Party of 1773. The following year, he represented Massachusetts as a representative to the Continental Congress. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and after the Americans won their war against the British, he served as the governor of the state of Massachusetts from 1794 to 1797. Initially, John Adams suffered for his decision to take on the defense of the British soldiers, as his law practice lost half of its clients. But Adams, having proved his integrity and support for justice even when his stance was at odds with the popular view, became one of the leaders of the fight for independence. After the war was won, he went on to a national role in politics. He became the U.S. president during a time of turmoil and only served a single term, but his place as one of the founding fathers whose intellect and devotion to his country played a monumental role in the nation's development has never been questioned. Conclusion. For the colonies, the event which became known as the Boston Massacre to the Americans and the incident on King Street to the Brits played its part in heaping more fuel upon the flames of rebellion against the British government and King George II. The anniversary of the day was commemorated annually as Massacre Day to continue to lead the public closer to separation from Britain. John Adams had a broader view of the event, regarding it as the foundation upon which American independence was laid. Boston's rage against British authority was a cornerstone of the move to independence. After the Boston Tea Party, when Bostonians masquerading as Native Americans dumped 342 chests of tea imported by the British East India Company into the harbor, British retaliation was severe. The British closed the port of Boston, shutting off trade until the city repaid Great Britain for the lost tea, an amount which would be approximately $1.4 million in modern currency, and for damages. British troops were quartered throughout the colonies. The British brought the Massachusetts Charter under British authority, limiting the local citizens' influence in government, limiting town hall meetings to one a year. Trials involving British officers and those loyal to the crown would be tried in Britain if they committed crimes in the colonies. Although prominent citizens in the other colonies, such as George Washington, disapproved of the destruction of the tea because it was private property, they were even more opposed to the British reaction to the action. The British actions were called the Intolerable Acts, and as a result, the colonies sent themselves to the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia, where they met from September 5th to October 26th, 1774, to debate colonial response to the punishment inflicted on Massachusetts. Their letter to King George II, in which they laid out the reasons for their displeasure and threatened to boycott all English goods if the government did not bring an end to the Intolerable Acts, was ignored. They agreed to meet again on May 10, 1775, as the Second Continental Congress, if there was no satisfactory resolution to the conflict between the mother country and her colonies. Before that could take place, several hundred British troops marched into Lexington, Massachusetts on April 19, 1775, meeting 77 militiamen who comprised the local defense against the professional army of Great Britain. The Battle of Lexington left 8 Americans dead, and the American Revolution had begun. This has been Boston Massacre, A History from Beginning to End, American Revolution Book 1, written by Hourly History, narrated by Matthew J. Chandler Smith. Copyright 2020 by Hourly History. Production copyright by Hourly History.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.